pretty straightforward.
Well, let's come to order. Yes. I realize we've kind of specialized a lot in our work here, but just to kind of break loose of the stereotype, I think Reps and Liebling should not move the minutes today, and somebody else should. I know we need someone else to step up. And the Reps and Hamilton, eager for recognition, his name's in the minutes. They'll know where he was today. He's not stuck in a snowbank here, working hard on behalf of Minnesota. Any questions about the minutes? They're an important part of our documentation. All in favor of those, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Good job. There we go. Kind of teamwork. We have four bills today.
What, me?
And I'm trying to get our first author here.
Oh, actually.
Should we just go to the next one? Okay. So if the people who are here to testify on 2253 want to come down, Ms. Hartner, why don't you come down and you can... We're just going to start without Representative Lohmer, and she'll be here shortly, I'm sure. So, and I see you have some. Hi, Representative Lohmer, you're at the table, so just take a get everything. So I have a chair, and maybe the pages can help pull up some chairs for our. Okay, that'll be. And actually, while we're waiting, in your packets, on the, I made. If you're curious about the forecast today. I made two salient pages copied of the forecast, and we're up $323 million from previous projections, which is a relief. And part of the improvement is the reduction in uptake on the early MA program, and also a few other minor things. So that is... very good. It removes, in my mind, likely we'll be having a negative target, which is good. Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I did ask a question when we had our presentation, and they have already accounted for the $30 million related to the PCA reimbursement, so that's already in there, and I guess saying we don't have to worry about it is not the right way to put it, but it's already built into the budget, that extra $30 million because of the court decision.
Right, and I think the specifics of it are that it's booked out till the end of the year. There's no 2012 money. I don't know what 2013 is. But, you know that, Mr. Berg, just that's a very... And so,
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding is it's at the unreduced rate to December 31st in the forecast. That's my understanding.
All right, so it's still booked to go into effect on January 1st, I think, of 2013. So at least they paid for any repair that if the court would make a finding, and then there's some other expectations. And so that's actually a burden off of our committee, which will now come out of the school shift. Which is where, and if you don't remember how the math works, we first restore the cash flow account, then the reserve account, and then it goes to the school shift. That's statutory. And under this current law, $318 million would go to pay back the school shift, which I think is 4.6%, 4.3, excuse me. That's why I have you here. Anyway, so that's that. So, Representative Lohmer, welcome to the committee. You want to move your bill, and I think you're going to go to the floor, right?
Okay. That's right. So, do you want me to move it?
Please, if you would.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2253. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House File 2253 would provide medical assistance coverage for out-of-state inpatient mental health treatment for children who are deaf, deaf-blind, or hard of hearing and use American Sign Language. Currently, these children do not have access to a 24-hour facility that has qualified mental health professional staff who can communicate with them directly and understand their unique mental health needs. The lack of coverage for facilities of this kind has resulted in either the child not getting the service that they need and becoming a threat to themselves, their schools, or society, or it has resulted in being sent to an inpatient facility in Minnesota with interpreter costs that add thousands of dollars a day to the medical assistance rate of $233.39. These staff are skilled in working with the general population, but do not have the specialized training needed to work with deaf youth. The solution is to include medical assistance coverage for out-of-state inpatient treatment facilities that specialize in providing mental health services to children who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, who use as their use ASL, American Sign Language, as their first language. There are several of these facilities in the country. An estimated 2 to 4 children a year need these services. The cost to the state and counties would be less. 14 other states have negotiated daily rates that average $500 a day. Children will get these specialized, get the specialized help that they need. And so today I have with me several people who can testify on behalf of this bill. Several parents were planning to come, Mr. Chair, but because of the weather weren't able to be here. So I think you have been had passed out to you Brady's story, so I hope you can read that. But my testifiers today are Sheena Krasner, Gassner, and Dr. Rebecca Goffman.
Well, welcome to the committee. Say your name, and then we're happy to hear your thoughts today.
My name is Sheena Gassner. I work at Fernbrook Family Center in Owatonna. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for listening to my testimony. I'm a social worker, and in 2011, I was given a referral for targeted children's mental health case management for a young man who attended the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. He had received a cochlear implant and relied primarily on this and lip reading until he began attending MSAD. He had been communicating in American Sign Language for only 2 years of his life. He was not just a student at MSAD. He also received services from the IMPACT program. This is an intensive outpatient mental health program located on the campus of the State School for the Deaf, operated by Volunteers of America. This program was developed to serve those children requiring additional therapeutic or behavioral supports who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. Despite this, he was struggling in the educational setting. He was assaulted to school personnel, absconded from the facility, engaged in high-risk behaviors, and damaged property. His behaviors were impacting his academic and therapeutic successes. Social interaction and communication was a significant struggle both in hearing and deaf relationships and in his family. He was unfamiliar with the deaf culture. As I mentioned, he'd only known sign for 2 years. His mother, too, had only been signing for 2 years, and his father did not know sign. He didn't have relationships in the dorms, he didn't have them at home, and this led to frustration and decline. He had about 6 trips to the emergency room in a 4-month period. He engaged in extremely high-risk behaviors, assaulted his mother, and threatened a neighborhood peer. His school placement was in jeopardy due to his behaviors. As a social worker, I was told there were no adequate services in the state of Minnesota. Being a bit stubborn, I was unable to take this at face value. For the next month, I spent many hours researching and subsequently corresponding via phone and email to obtain appropriate services. I located the placement that I felt was going to serve his needs best in Florida. As a parent to a similar age child, I first addressed the barrier of distance with his family. They amazingly made arrangements for Dad to quit his job and to go live with an acquaintance in Florida so that they felt safe letting their young man receive the care he needed so far from home. The county agreed to cover the additional costs, but medical assistance would not cover the therapeutic services. I realized that this was not an inexpensive proposition. Initially, I was quoted a per diem of $750 for the National Deaf Academy. All of their staff are fluent in ASL and have extensive experience working with deaf youth. The facility was willing to negotiate a lower rate for the state of Minnesota. I contacted every department within DHS that I thought was even remotely connected to what I needed for the student. I contacted medical assistants repeatedly as well, and the Office of the Ombudsman. I continued to hear this was not possible, that due to statute, it just couldn't happen. His behaviors were escalating. I felt forced to look at options that were less than ideal within the state. An inpatient residential mental health treatment facility for youth in Duluth stepped up and agreed to meet his needs as best they could. An intake meeting was arranged to start the process and develop an understanding of what these services would look like. They were thoughtful enough to ask the Duluth School District to join us for this meeting. The representative from the district suggested that he receive 24-hour-a-day interpretation services. I thought this was unnecessary, thinking, why would he need this when he's sleeping? Then I realized that he frequently misunderstood what was being said unless he had a sign language interpreter present. I understood that despite the cochlear implant, he was unable to decipher the words he was hearing. And I began to think, well, what if there's a fire or a tornado? How do they communicate this to him from a sleeping state? What do you suppose 24 hours a day, 7 days a week interpretation services cost? On the low side, a sign language interpreter costs $50 an hour. The facility would need two interpreters. This would come to $1,800 to $3,200 a day. We're in a recession. The state budget is in the red. Services for individuals with mental health, mental illnesses are being cut left and right. The most cost-effective solution is to have specialized inpatient treatment services of this kind covered by MA. The average rate negotiated by states is $500 a day. The cost would be lower, and the children would get the appropriate mental health services needed. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being so stubborn. Dr. Goffman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Rebecca Goffman, and I work for Volunteers of America. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to thank Representative Lohmer for introducing this important piece of legislation and allowing me to testify in support of House File 2253, which will allow medical assistance to pay for out-of-state, culturally affirmative inpatient mental health care. Like I said, I'm Dr. Rebecca Goffman. I'm a teacher and a psychologist who has had the privilege of working with and learning from deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people for over 20 years. As a mental health professional, I have seen hundreds of kids with hearing loss successfully manage symptoms of anxiety and depression and other disorders with typical outpatient therapy. There have been three or four who've needed inpatient care because their symptoms cause them to be unsafe. Minnesota does not currently have a program that can effectively meet their needs. To fully understand the importance of providing culturally affirmative mental health services to this population, try to imagine yourself, a hearing person at your worst moment in life, being sent to a mental health institution where everyone around you is deaf, ASL is the only language used to communicate, and all treatment decisions are made through a deaf lens. Imagine trying to learn from your therapist and your peers and your support system when communication is limited to basic gestures like when you play charades, or the ability of an interpreter to get the full message across. Could you trust your therapist to fully understand your needs? Would you be willing to try new things? Could you effectively participate in groups? No, you couldn't. In fact, it's more likely feelings of frustration and oppression would worsen your symptoms, and you'd be acting out more. In truth, you're all hearing, and you're probably pretty resilient. You would likely try to learn sign language so that you can integrate yourself into that therapeutic community. It would take longer for you to succeed, but you could do it. In cases of a child with hearing loss, no matter how resilient he is, he will never have the option of learning how to listen with his ears and effectively communicate in spoken English. As a mental health professional, I am increasingly being asked to apply evidence-based practices to improve outcomes. The goal, provide the best care in the least restrictive environment for the least cost. As you can see from the above example, the only way to do this is through culturally affirmative care. Understanding how hearing loss can affect development across a broad range of areas is imperative because it influences everything from diagnosis to treatment to aftercare planning. A therapeutic environment that embraces deaf culture inherently enhances the deaf client's ability to fully benefit from the program, improves outcomes, and integrates that child back into their natural environment in a more timely and cost-effective way. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee, for allowing me the opportunity to speak today in support of House File 2253. Please vote yes to change the statute. Thank you.
Thanks. We have time for a question or two. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Representative Lohmer. This is a very special situation. I don't think any of us can imagine how difficult it is for children in this situation, not necessarily that they're put in. And so it is not something that every state necessarily has to have because it is a very unique specialty care. One question I have about your bill, though, just is on the page 2, a member state of the Interstate Compact on Mental Health. Is that necessary to have that in regards to?
We're phoning a friend.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm going to let Mary Hartnett answer that question.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hartnett.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer and members of the committee, in 2009, legislation was passed that allowed...
You have to tell us who you are.
I'm sorry. Mary Hartnett with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. Mm-hmm. In 2009, legislation was passed that allowed children who had a mental illness who needed inpatient care to go to facilities that were in border states, and an interstate compact was created to make sure that it meets the standards that are set by the state of Minnesota for mental health facilities. So that interstate compact now is signed by those border states, and then the states that qualify would also be added to this pact. So we want that bar to be high.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hartnett. I appreciate that. I knew you were there and could answer the question. And I appreciate that. So has Florida signed into this interstate compact?
Ms. Hartnett. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, until this bill is passed, they would not be able to. And so once the bill is passed, then the other states, I believe there are three other facilities that have services of this kind, and they could come forward. Right now, the gold standard is Florida, but that could change. You know how that fluctuates over time. So we want other facilities to be able to enter into this, and if they meet the same standard and bar that the state has set, then they would be students would be eligible to be sent to those, or clients would be eligible to be sent to those facilities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That clarifies it, and thank you.
Sure. Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses. I'm wondering whether or not we ought to be developing our own capability within Minnesota. I mean, I understand that we might not have it, but I'm aware of a mental health treatment program that's both residential and does telemedicine very effectively. They have clients all over the state of Minnesota. They use big, you know, TV, Skype sort of things, and communicate with groups even using ASL with the kind of technology that's available now. They've been able to create a community, a supportive community amongst adults who are deaf in all different parts of the state by using technology. And to me, I always think that children are best served if they can stay at home with their family and the family can be engaged in it, and then the aftercare is available within the state, and the relationships that are formed oftentimes in treatment are as important as the ones with the therapist, and so being able to connected to those other people who are going through that same journey. And, you know, what would it take for our state to incentivize or develop that kind of capability? You know, we have made commitments through the state schools for the deaf and other things to specialty population services, and I think our long-range plan shouldn't be to send kids out of state just because we haven't had providers creative enough to step up.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, there was a Children's Mental Health Task Force that was convened about 3 years ago that had some of the best and the brightest at the table to look at what the capabilities were to create an inpatient treatment program within the state of Minnesota. And because the numbers are so low for 24-hour staffing and having that support, there were only an estimated two to four kids that they an outpatient facility has been created that takes care of a lot of the kids in the state of Minnesota, and they stay at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf campus, and their behaviors are not so severe that they're a threat to themselves and to others. There are only 2 to 4 kids estimated a year that will need this level of treatment. So as a result of that, Children's Mental Health Task Force Project Impact was created through Volunteers of America. So a lot of what you're talking about is currently happening through Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division, through DHS, through dollars that are allocated, that this committee has allocated. We have provided infrastructure in place for a lot of these, for adults, and we're starting to look at providing them more for kids. And this lifeline that we have is excellent, and they provide excellent care. But there are just a few kids that we're not able to take care of, and in those few instances, it's too expensive for us to put those systems in place to be able to care for those kids.
Representative Laughlin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just know that we go to amazing expenses in special education and other areas, and we've somehow been able to figure out how to serve isolated populations effectively close to home, and I hope that still remains our goal. But I appreciate the fact that you've really looked at it.
Anybody else? Okay, Ms. Lomer, do you want to say a final word? And
well, thank you, Mr.
Urge
Chair.
People to vote for
thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill. I think it's a great bill, and I would like to renew my motion that House File 2253 be passed and moved to the floor.
Okay, any questions about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's passed and on the way to the General Register, and thank you very much to all the witnesses.
Much.
And be sure you read the testimony of that young fellow. It's pretty compelling. So, Next is Representative Slawick with her crew. Representative Slawick, you have the most witnesses of the day, and we have two other bills, so if you can kind of organize those in maybe 15, 20 minutes tops, that would be nice.
Can you get them? We're doing that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So there's plenty of time. We just want to... So perfect. We're right on time. So welcome to the committee, and do you want to move your bill for possible inclusion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that possible inclusion?
Right.
I'd like to move House File 2331 for possible inclusion.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for shining out to the bill. It's nice to see a Slawick and Abler bill. I very much appreciate that. Second of all, I did talk to the CA, Christine, about the number of testifiers. We're going to try to make them brief, and understanding that is a lot of them.
We do like variety, however, so that's always good.
Thank you. Members, this is an important bill, House File 2331. It would reinstate the exemption to the absent day limit for children of teen parents who are attending school and receiving child care assistance in school-based programs. In addition, these programs provide parenting support, social services, career, and employment services. During the 2011 legislative session, this exception was eliminated and the number of excusable absences was reduced to 10. This change would take effect in 2013. What's important, members, about keeping teen moms and their kids going while the mom finishes high school is if they don't finish high school, there could be a devastating impact on our economy. The adolescent parent faces multiple barriers such as homelessness, domestic abuse, lack of support from family or the community, mental health barriers. And a lot of you probably know, but I teach at the University of Minnesota also. I teach a course on early childhood and public policy, and we spend a whole week talking about teenage pregnancy and how really that is difficult and continues the cycle of poverty often, and often those kids are then in the same situation. So what we want to do is try to break that cycle, and part of what this bill does is that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask my testifiers to take it from here.
Please, introduce yourself, please. And
okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deb Bennett, and I'm the director of the CAPE Child Care Centers with the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And we are a DHS-licensed child care center that operates within the school district. Our child care provides care for the children of the teen parents who are enrolled in any school program in the Anoka-Hennepin School District. We currently have 26 children enrolled in our program, ranging in ages from 8 weeks to 4 years. The parents of our children range in age from 15 to 18, and that's at the present time. We have actually had parents as young as 12 years old in our program. And you can gasp now because I did. I'm here today to tell you that I support House File number 2331, which would exempt teen parents and their children who are enrolled in a school-based program from the 10 absent days limit that's to be imposed on any recipient of child care assistance beginning in January of 2013, and my reasons for supporting that bill. In an attempt to determine the outcome of this bill for our program in our child care center, I analyzed the absent days that were used in our center during the 2011 calendar year. During that time period, the whole 2011 calendar year, we serviced 48 children and 46 teen parents. The number of children who enrolled in our center for the entire 2011 calendar year and who had less than 10 absent days during that time period was actually zero. The number of children that were enrolled in our center that had 10 absent days if medical exemption was in place was only 3. When considering that the entire 48 children that are attending our child care center, even if we took the 10 absent days and children that weren't enrolled for the entire calendar year, we still only had 14 children out of all of them that didn't exceed the 10 absent days. My concern for that is that once they exceed the 10 absent days, they have no means to pay for the child care themselves. We can't bill them, and consequently, they're no longer able to have child care in our center.
It may seem like an excessive number of days to you to miss more than 10 days, but we're actually looking at absent days for two children for the most part, not just one. The teen parent is also somewhat of a child herself, and so we're looking at days for two children. We're looking at a problem such as personal illness. Personal illness is a huge reason for absences, and we're looking at children that are in group settings where there are more possibilities of becoming ill, of, you know, germ spreading and that type of thing. And again, we are multiplying that times two because we're looking at the parent possibly becoming ill as well as the child becoming ill. There are many other reasons that our teen parents experience absences. Some of those are county-required appointments and meetings. Sometimes they're court dates for paternity and other issues, counseling, therapy appointments, preschool visitations, college visits. Sometimes even illness of the teen parent's parent can prove to be a barrier and keep them from attending school and from being in child care. Another huge concern that I have with the cost of the 10 absent days and reducing and limiting to 10 absent days is the cost to our program. We do operate within the Anoka-Hennepin School District. We do have certain things that are provided, such as space by the school district, but the main cost of operating our center, employee salaries and benefits, food for the children, equipment, basically anything that's required to operate a child care center is our responsibility and not provided by the school district. The only funding that we do have available for that is the child care assistant funding that we're able to collect when we bill for the children that are in our center. I do want to make it really clear, however, that I'm not advocating just for unlimited absent days for our students. The actual goal is to get these students through school, to get them to graduate from high school so that they can have a more productive life and a better life for both themselves and their children. But I don't think it's necessary to put limits on child care center or child care assistance absent days in order to limit the number of absent days. The school programs are already doing that. For example, with the alternative program within our district, students are required to be in school 90% of the time, and they're required to meet 90% academics. And if they don't do that, they're put on a contract. They have 3 weeks to get up to the 90-90. If they don't make it that far, then at the end of their three-week contract, they lose their schedule, have to go to maintenance classes, possibly get put on a waiting list in order to return to school. And our students don't want to go through that. So they try very hard to maintain their academic and attendance requirements in order to stay in school. And then a final point that I think is really important for allowing more than 10 absent days is we need to take a look at the safety of the children themselves. We know that we're providing good quality care for the children when they're in our care, as opposed to when the students don't have the alternative of the licensed child care center. Sometimes these children are left in really unsafe situations. Quite honestly, I've known of parents who don't even know the last name of the person they've left their child with. That concerns me greatly. We're looking at very vulnerable young children. So that's something that is extremely important. Not only are these students in school working towards graduation, we also require a parenting class for every student in our child care center. We're trying to teach them not only to be good, responsible students to graduate from high school, but we're also trying to teach them how to be good parents and best practices for raising their child. And quite frankly, these children are generally from pretty dysfunctional families for the most part and haven't had these good parenting skills exhibited to them. So we're trying to break that cycle and trying to help them become good parents. And most importantly, our major goal, while it does sound like it's providing child care for children, our major goal is to get these moms through school so they can graduate, go on to having a good, productive, meaningful job, go on to a post-secondary program, become responsible adults, and have a better life for themselves and their children. And we really feel that limiting the number of absent days is going to severely limit their ability to attend school and do that.
Well, thanks, Ms. Bennett. I think that kind of helped tell the whole tale. It's very comprehensive testimony. I appreciate that. So I know you have other witnesses, and they can kind of fill in the gap. Sometimes witnesses repeat what the other one said. So say something new, and that would be nice.
Something new.
We have our attention spans, and a lot of us belong in daycare sometimes.
Thank you. My name is Lee Dahl. I'm with Intermediate District 287, which is a collaborative of 12 school districts in Hennepin County, including Osseo, Edina, Eden Prairie, St. Louis Park, to mention a few. I'm a licensed K-12 principal, and 287 largely does special ed and alternative ed types of programming, and I am the principal for the alternative ed programs, two of which have pregnant and parenting programs at their locations, and we have daycares. And I'm here to ask for your support of House File 2331. And yes, there was quite a bit of overlap there, and so let me see if I can go to my 3 points quickly. I think the most important one that I want to make is teaching our students long-term independence from the county and the county funding. It's a high price to pay for our students to end up supported by county services as well as their children, and we're working really hard to break the cycle of poverty. And just to tag on about the 90% attendance rate for the student expectation, with this 10-day rule, it'd be 93% for the babies, so it's actually higher for the babies than the students, which is interesting and hard to enforce. I also wanted to make the point that having specific teen programs results in positive social outcomes and does work to break the cycle of poverty. As you mentioned, 25 days is for two people, and if mom's sick, baby can't come, and if baby's sick, mom can't come. So it's real important that we adhere and use that or access that. It's also important to note that this isn't a request for an increase, but to maintain what we've had for several years and been able to work with for the last few years. Finally, at-risk students miss school for the very reasons that make them at risk, and a policy that discourages them from attending because their daycare has been cut off is not good policy. It's unfair to shift the burden of the expense of the daycare, because we have fixed expenses for the daycare, to the schools when school funding is so tight, and it's essential that we pay attention and empower our young people instead of punishing them. And thank you, and I ask your support of 2331.
Well, thanks. And Upson Slavic, this is to take effect at the middle of the next school year. Is that right? January 1st?
January.
Right.
That's January.
Right.
The middle.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Well, I'm just trying to get my arms around it. Thank you. Who's next?
I'm Ruth Kruger. I'm the Director of Employment and Economic Assistance for Dakota County, and I'm here on behalf of the MACSA, the County Social Services Directors. We agree with the testimony you've heard so far. We agree to the point where most of us continue to add teen parents to our child care programs, even when we're out of money, because you don't get a do-over for these teen parents. We need to keep them in school. If they can't stay in school, it's a major issue, and thank you. We don't want them coming back to the county in their 20s and 30s either. So keeping them in school, we support this. It's a great program. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Osborne, and I'm the program director for Northside Child Development Center in North Minneapolis. Quick points that weren't mentioned, I just want to say that Northside is a learning center in North Minneapolis. We provide early education. 100% of our families are eligible for the Child Care Assistance Program. The average income of the families at the center is $14,500 for about a family of three. Now, I'd just like to say it's not just the teen parents whose kids are missing the days of child care for valid reasons. Besides transportation, it gets very complicated living in poverty, and there are many reasons why they miss. Just if you support the bill, which recognizes the challenges that teen parents face, please also recognize the challenges that extremely low-income parents face and support reverting back to the 25-day absent day allowance for all families in the CCAP program. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And Ms. Osborne, so it's not just school daycares. It's also the ones that are adjacent or nearby that people would use. Okay.
Correct. Yep. We work with teen families and also low-income families.
All right. Great. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. This bill, which seeks to reinstate the exception to the restriction on absent days for teenage parents, can have a significant impact on the well-being of teen parents and their young children, but also on the prosperity of our state. Young people who become parents before they are able to provide for their children, and while they are still children themselves, face many more challenges than adults who become parents. Supportive relationships, a high school diploma, employment, stable housing, emotional and physical energy and health. These are all things that take longer, and rightfully so, to attain and achieve. This bill recognizes the many obstacles teenage parents encounter and the reality that teenage parents and their young children will have a number of absences due to experiences associated with poverty, many of which you've already heard about today. The children of teenage parents are young. The vast majority are infants and toddlers under the age of 3. These early years are a time of rapid and critical brain development. In fact, 90% of a child's brain is formed by the time that they're 5 years old. And that development depends largely on the nutritional, medical, emotional, and intellectual support a child receives from her or his parents, extended family, and community. We know that early experiences affect the way a child's brain develops, and that adverse childhood experiences, again, risk factors often associated with poverty, can produce a toxic level of stress and disrupt the architecture of a child's developing brain. Parents, especially very young parents, who are immersed in a daily struggle to ensure that their children and they themselves have enough to eat and a warm, safe place to stay, in addition to the challenges of being a new parent and going to high school, may have difficulty in the absence of appropriate supports providing an environment that fosters optimal brain development. Infants and toddlers who have little opportunity to explore and experiment in a stimulating and nurturing environment may develop a fragile foundation, a foundation that will make later learning more challenging. Research indicates that children of teenage parents are at higher risk of several negative outcomes, including poor academic achievement, delinquency, substance abuse, homelessness, and becoming teenage parents themselves. You have another opportunity here with this bill to help decrease this risk for infants and toddlers. School-based programs that offer comprehensive services and supports for teenage parents, including parenting skills, which you've heard about, and provide quality child care for infants and toddlers are integral to the well-being of parents and their children. These programs address the needs of both young parents and their young children, helping ensure that parents know how to provide a stimulating and nurturing environment for their children while also providing quality and consistent care to their infants and toddlers. These important programs are poised to meet school-age parents where they are and help them become successful parents and adults. And as a result, these young children, our future workers, parents, and leaders, will benefit. I can't say enough how important these services are for parents and their children, but I appreciate you giving me the opportunity and the time to come here today and talk with you about this bill, and I also look forward to continuing to work with the members of this committee to ensure that more children and their families aren't impacted by the absent day restrictions that will go into effect next year. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. And Ms. Nino.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Nino. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. Child Care Works is a statewide child care advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain high-quality, affordable child care options for families and children. I'm pleased to testify today in support of House File 2331. Child Care Works recognizes that the children of teen parents and teen parents themselves are among some of our most vulnerable populations and do deserve additional support and services in order to be successful in life. Child Care Works testified before this committee last session in opposition to the reduction in absent days from 25 to 10, recognizing the unintended consequences such a policy would have, which you are now hearing about today. As you consider the bill, I hope you will also reflect upon the wider impacts, as Kimberly indicated, that an absent day limit has on all vulnerable families who will be put in the position of having to choose between losing or quitting jobs to care for sick children or having to bring unwell children into child care settings, creating additional health risks for all the children in that setting. During last year's shutdown, Child Care Works received hundreds of stories that demonstrated how fragile our child care system really is. Some families and providers were literally days away from losing jobs, home foreclosure, and closing of child care programs when we heard that child care assistance would be restored. While the absent day limit created a small state savings, it certainly will have negative impacts on the retention of jobs for three separate populations. First, the child care providers who will not be reimbursed for ill children and may need to stop providing care. Second, the parents who will have to choose between working or caring for their ill children. And three, the children who represent our future workforce who will be subjected to disjointed care, which we know can be toxic to healthy brain development in young children. And for private businesses, while most childcare settings, which most childcare settings are, there isn't the luxury of only paying their teachers one-tenth of their salary if 9 out of 10 children are absent due to illness. There is no reduction in their rent when children are absent, and so while they have fixed costs, what the absent day limit does is create an unreliable revenue source, making it nearly impossible to employ a sustainable business model. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, based upon a survey of private pay parents in centers around the state, children and infants had on average 23 to 24 absent days per year. It seems reasonable, at least to me, that families receiving child care assistance would be allowed the same number of paid absent days as our private pay parents. Thank you so much. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
And that's your testifiers. Thanks. Questions from members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
We have a couple
Chairman?
Minutes for questions. We're doing fine, but we have to keep playing. So, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman.
A real question today?
A real question today.
It's a good time for it.
It is. Thank you. A great program, I believe. Certainly, I think many do. Question for you, Representative Slawick, on sections 1.19. Is there a limit on the number of part of the day that the child is able to go to the daycare providers?
Representative Slawick. You see that?
I do see it. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, 1.19. So if the child attends part of an authorized day, I would ask Ms. Nino.
So we may want to ask the department that. My interpretation is if they're absent for part of the day.
Maybe the department wants to come down.
Yeah, and then the payment would be for the entire. I assume it would be for the entire day.
Yes. Well, they're coming down, yes. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. I think the idea that you're paying workers and you pay for lunch and all those types of things, and so if a child becomes ill or has to go or is not there for that full day, that they get reimbursed. But
hello. Hi, I'm Dawn Van Ryan. I'm with Child Care Assistance. Mr. Chair, Representatives, the language basically states that if a child attends for any part of a day, that day does not count toward the absent limit. So as long as they've shown up, it wouldn't be counted toward that 10-day limit or, you know, whatever that limit.
And is that current policy?
That is current policy.
Okay, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that's what I interpreted as well, but I'm just curious if there's a limit of the numbers. For example, if someone perhaps was going 9 out of 10 times was there just for a few hours, so I'm wondering if there's a limit to that, how often he can be just there part of the time.
Ms. Van Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, no, there is not.
Can I just add, from a school perspective, repetitive tardinesses would require us to file tardiness with the county and pursue that with the student and have to work on that, obviously, to improve it.
Thank you, Ms. Stahl. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking on 1.18 where it says may exceed the 10 days. Is there any limit to how many days they can miss, or just may exceed goes to what number?
Is Ms. Van Ryan or Ms. Nino, whichever.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if the 10 absent limit was not in place and this policy was implemented, which is current policy now, no, there is no other limit that would cap that under this, under the law.
Representative Lomer. Okay. Representative Solik, do you want to sum up?
Thank you.
And then we'll hold it over. So I think this has been very productive and I think a good discussion and more child care in this committee, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to just say we had lots of child care in your committee. So I do appreciate, and I appreciate you signing on the bill. I think that it used to be 25 days, Representative Lomer, and the you know, probably you like me thinks, well, what, there's got to be an upper limit. So, you know, that's something we could talk about, you know, is rather than, and I know that may not make everybody happy, but perhaps you do have some higher level, because in our minds, then we know there's a limit. So that would be one thought. But I think this is a really important bill. I mean, this whole cycle of poverty and the part about teenage parents and helping them succeed, because when they succeed, their children succeed. Oh. The basic determinant of how a child does is the education level of the mother. And I don't know if people have heard that. So, you know, there's some thoughts. So the higher the education level of the mother, the better the child does. So should the legislature be investing in children, or should they be investing in mothers, you know, and in higher education? Really, what we do here is both, but it's an intriguing idea. You know, so really what this program does is it helps both of them. We lift all boats, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lee has been provoked to ask a question. So
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
We get the last question.
Sorry, Representative Slawick, after your great closing there, but the question kind of raised a question in my mind about this idea that there's no upper limit, but in the bill it says upon request of the program and approval of the county. So I assume that means the county is not going to just, you know, say, gosh, no limit at all, go ahead, never show up, and everything gets paid for. I mean, I assume that the county has an interest in making sure that the absences are legitimate, that there's a reason, or that there's a reason to pay for them, certainly. Am I correct there?
And you kind of have two parallel things. You got on the daycare absences, but you also have the student absences. And we're required by law, if the students have 15 days of consecutive absence, we have to drop them. So you have kind of two systems that are kind of checks and balances with absenteeism. And we'd be working with the county and trying to address that and figure out why the truancy was going on.
Mr. Liebling, is that sufficient?
Mr. Chair, I'll just say in all of our programs for low-income people, people are always wondering about fraud and abuse and what people might be doing. And having a teenage daughter, we know teens are they're hard to deal with right there. You know, and then you add in all the things what being a teen parent would do. But I think that the department's really done a good job of starting to address if there are any problems. And like you said, the county, it's in their best interest. I mean, they don't want to see things happen. And I think most of these parents, teen parents, are trying as hard as they can, but it doesn't take long for things to start adding up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just the answer to the question about there's a limit, actually, it's not a hard limit, but it's a scrutinized number. So
exactly.
I guess that's the clear answer. Mm-hmm. So there is some oversight. So I think we're happy about that. You want to do any? Want to close again, or was that you just want to say what I said? Okay.
Rewind.
Representative Slavik renews her motion that the bill be held over and we'll quote over ahead. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Thanks
Chair.
To all the witnesses. Next, we'll take up the Representative Murphy's bill. And there was an amendment that did not meet the deadline for the process. So, Representative Murphy, I think in terms of the technicalities of the amendment, I think if the number, you can discuss different numbers if you want, but I think the whole program is what we want to hear about today, since it's not familiar to a lot of us. So, and the details of the technicalities of your amendment, you can mention if you want. So,
thank
it's
you.
Your bill. Do what you want with it. How's that? And we have this bill and one other, and so you can, I think it will be fitting in the time perfectly. So welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2440 for possible inclusion. And I'll just mention those amendments. We do have a couple of amendments that we had prepared but didn't make the deadline that would further express how these dollars would be used. And if for some reason we get to the point at which we would be considering this in the markup of a bill, we could bring those amendments forward. So today we'll just talk conceptually about the idea of sexual violence prevention, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have this bill heard today. I think twice this session we have had hearings on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and its growing costs to the Health and Human Services budget and to the state of Minnesota. Minnesota will spend $143 million in the Sex Offender Program in the 12 and 13 budget, and that money increases again in the budget that follows. And this doesn't account for any of the costs of incarceration for sexual offenders. In contrast, we spend zero on primary prevention of sexual violence. 61,000 Minnesotans per year are victims of sexual violence. Sexual violence disproportionately affects women, young girls and children, people of color, and disabled Minnesotans. The annual economic impact of sexual violence in Minnesota is estimated to be about $8 billion, and we're investing zero in primary prevention. So I think that it is time for us to have a discussion and make some decisions about investing in primary prevention, not only to look forward and try and ratchet down costs in the state budget, but also to protect the life and the health of Minnesotans that are currently victims. We have a letter from Dennis Benson. He is the executive director from the Sex Offender Program. And I have Donna Dunn with me here today from MnCASA, and I'd like to introduce her to the committee, and she can tell you just a little bit more. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn. I am the director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2440, and to give you a little bit of a vision of what these, what we would be seeing these community demonstration projects to be doing. This bill would provide one-time funding for community-based sexual violence prevention networks or partnerships. These teams would be, in fact, able to pilot and evaluate some systems for providing state funding for sexual violence prevention in Minnesota. These would be similar to teams that we are currently supporting from MnCASA. We call these teams SMART teams, and they're actually collaborative teams of criminal justice professionals who are working together in many communities across Minnesota to establish a victim-centered response to incidents of sexual violence. Well, we want to use the same model that we've used with those criminal justice teams to start and to support some crime prevention or sexual violence prevention teams. This is a tried model that has been proven successful. We are, in fact, technical assistance providers to grantees who are funded across the country by the Office on Violence Against Women. So we know this is a model that works. What we see these teams or networks doing is working from a public health approach to preventing injury and violence. We would be expecting these teams would be working on activities that would support the five-year Minnesota Department of Health sexual violence prevention plan. We would expect these teams, and we would guide these teams to start focusing on some of what we have learned through the ACE study, and you heard that reference too in the last testimony, the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, which has taught us a lot about how lifelong negative health outcomes are often the experience as a result of adverse childhood experiences, many of which would incorporate sexual violence and child sexual abuse. We would also see these teams working with what we know about asset building and strength building in terms of how we grow healthy and strong youth in our communities who exhibit and behave in pro-social ways, not anti-social ways. These teams would be populated by diverse partners. We would see school people, faith-based communities, maybe local policymakers involved with the teams. And these teams would be, the money would be, and the project would be administered through the Minnesota Department of Health with a close connection to the Department of Public Safety and the existing victim advocacy programs. Representative Murphy gave you all of the information that you need to know about why we need to be doing this. The data about the prevalence of sexual violence and the fact that many of those 61,000 Minnesota victims in 1 year are in fact children. We know that that the first experience that many men and women have with sexual violence occurs during childhood. In fact, of the 61,000, over 17,000 of those would be expected to have been children. Because Because of this, we know that prevention needs to start early, and it needs to not only focus on families, but also on the environment. It needs to address the beliefs, the attitudes, and the messages that create the climate that condones sexual violence. We believe that this model would be a great one to use in communities. The benefits of it would be that each community team would be able to tailor the strategies to fit their community based on where they see the strengths in their community for supporting prevention. It's a collaborative model that requires that there are many voices at the table who will come together to find common purpose and a collective voice to use in their community. And these teams will receive technical assistance to help them be effective in the work they do. Ultimately, in Minnesota, we need a balanced response to the problem of sexual violence and child sexual abuse. We have seen that many of our resources and much of our policy focuses on picking up the pieces after harm has been caused, after harm has occurred. We really believe that it's time now to start working to stop the harm from existing in the first place. This prevention needs to be a part of our broad response in the state of Minnesota. The CDC recently issued a very comprehensive study about the prevalence of sexual violence across the United States, including our state. And what they have said about prevention is that they have learned a lot of lessons in the public health model, which have helped them understand how to prevent chronic infections and chronic disease. And they are saying that they have learned that those lessons also apply to the prevention of violence. They say, in fact, quote, sexual violence can be prevented with data-driven collaborative action. And that's what these teams would embody. Thank you.
Well, thanks. That's your testifier, sir. So can you just give me an idea? I'm just reading the proposed amendment in the original bill, and which nobody has the proposed amendment, but it's the same kind of idea. I've been here a while, and we put money aside to accomplish something, and it seems like a really worthy cause. That's which is why I gave it a hearing, because I thought it was kind of a valuable thing to at least talk about. And so you're going to have a certain number of communities of these demonstration communities. And so what does $35,000 or so really buy when you get that down to the operational level? Is that buy a bunch of brochures or pay for meeting space or get some neighbors together? Or can you just tell me what that would look like?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do that. Following the model that we've used with criminal justice teams, each of those teams in Minnesota has a staff person, a part-time staff person that supports the work, that makes sure that the direction that the team is going is, in fact, meeting the guidelines of the funding and that meets the needs of the community. So we would be looking at really providing a staff person for each of these teams to make sure that the work moves forward. We have worked with many communities in the state of Minnesota around the issue of sexual violence prevention. We have many places in Minnesota where there are fledgling teams that want to do something, but there are not the resources to really support the staffing to make those teams actually viable.
And so it'd be a part-time position,
yes.
Obviously. And so these are like students or like community leaders or
What we have seen, the person who makes an effective team leader on a multidisciplinary team of this sort is somebody who can deal with a variety of different opinions and different personalities, who can help people move to a common a point of reference that they can all agree on and move forward on. This person really is skilled in facilitation. So it's quite a sophisticated role to play with a multidisciplinary team.
Well, I didn't mean that, but I mean who makes up the team? Is this like
who makes up the team?
One of the local public health groups that would kind of just be working in their town, or a bunch of teachers or nurses perhaps that would be interested in this, or what does it look like? I'm just trying to get my arms around it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the makeup of a team could vary. Could really depend on the community that's involved. We would anticipate that schools would participate, that youth and child-serving agencies would participate. I was very interested in hearing some of the testimony just previous to this, thinking there are some child care centers would be a good place to also be involved with this. We have worked with individuals in some communities who are working in the suicide prevention area, and they see that working in preventing child sexual abuse and sexual violence connects with suicide prevention. So it could be public health people. In some communities, we would love to see the business community involved so that they can see how their contribution to stopping this can, in fact, affect their bottom line. We've seen communities that have that would like to draw on the arts community. So it can this group could be quite varied depending on the particular interests of the county or the community that's working on this. But clearly those people who have the interests and safety of children at heart would be central to this work.
And so you're more training leaders, or are you interfacing with the common general public somehow?
Mr. Chair, this group could be doing all of those things. We see the need to train leaders. We see the need to train people who are working in immediate contact with children about understanding the kinds of behaviors that support and condone sexual violence and helping to develop pro-social skills with kids. We see this as being maybe the faith community taking on broadly in a community action to say we are going to work across all of the faith leaders in our county or in our community to do several actions that will draw attention to this. So it's partly awareness raising. Largely what we would like to see these teams do is also address policy change at the local level, whether at the school board level, city council, an interfaith community level, or whatever.
Well, thanks. And there's time for some questions. So, Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have one?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think we all certainly agree with the goal of prevention in this area. That's not a question at all. I think more is a matter of the tools and the vehicle, and some of that concern I have is $70,000 of administration expenses out of $350,000. I think the other thing is I'm looking at Mr. Benson, who already has hired a prevention policy director who works in DHS, and that's already a salary that's there. I think the other thing is along the line of what Representative Mr. Chairman is talking about here, and I see in here social norms, environmental factors, peer influence, individual decision making that precedes an act of sexual violence. So decision making, meaning the mental mindset or something like that. And so I just really find these descriptions in here somewhat concerning. And so just a variety of things like that. So I think, you know, the defining things, I think it's pretty much fairly vague, and the epidemiological assessment, I don't think anybody has to tell us that sexual violence hurts and all of that, so I think we have that. But anyway, maybe you might just want to respond to that in some way. I know that's a lot of things bundled into one bunch of questions, but it kind of exemplifies the general approach. What do you mean by... I did, I know. I realize that. But I also wanted to give them an opportunity to just respond in general. What you mean by individual decision-making... And by the way, this is from Mr. Benson's letter. But he's writing it in support of the bill, so it's not language that's in the bill, but it's in it. I thought I made that...
Well, Ms. Dunn, do you want to take a shot at that?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative... what I would say that your question points to is that we're talking about an incredibly complex issue, and much of what we have termed prevention in the past is really focused on risk reduction. We put a lot of effort into telling victims or potential victims how to behave in ways that will make them less likely to become victims. The approach that the public health model is looking at is how do we take what we've learned from those people who work with sex offenders and trying to determine what causes somebody to engage in sex offending behavior. And it's from those lessons and from what we've learned about the adverse childhood experience study that leads us to say how do we help people develop behaviors and decision making processes that are protective and that are pro social instead of antisocial.
You know, and from my perspective, Chair, from my perspective, you know, the Department of Health, I think, did a report. They issued a report, I think, the year I got elected, on prevention of sexual violence. And they've done a lot of research, and they have a lot of expertise, particularly in primary prevention. And that report has sat without action, largely without action in Minnesota. We know that 61,000 people, many women and children, continue to be victimized each year.
if this isn't the right solution, that's okay. But I think we should come up with the right solution. I think we should act, because knowing that 61,000 Minnesotans each year are being victimized is just too much. And we know that we're spending a lot of money on the budget at the incarceration end and the treatment end. So I'm thinking, you know, a little bit of money at this end is a good idea.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get at is it's very difficult when it's so broad and like this to have an outcome, you know, because it's a good effort, and so there's a little bit of that plus the administration expenses. But I appreciate your comments, and I was sitting here thinking how I could, and I just couldn't come up with some of those things, but we can chat about it some more. Thank you.
I'd welcome that very much, Representative Kiffmeyer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy, I think this is a great idea. And, you know, so a few of us just went and visited the MSOP program last Friday. And, you know, what's really, really troubling about that is that here are people who have a trail of victims, a trail. And we're not even people who come out of prison and have a trail of victims, we're not even putting all of them into that program. In other words, we are just touching the tiny, tiny little surface of the problem, and we're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to do it. And that's only after the fact. You know, I don't know if we can figure out better at the front end, but if we're going to talk about outcomes, you know, we don't even have any data to show that we are actually reducing sexual violence in our state with all those millions of dollars at the back end. 30 states don't have a civil commitment program. And I've been looking into this, and there is nobody seems to have any data to show that the 30 that do that expensive back-end thing are any more safe than the states that don't have anything. So, you know, to have a little bit of money to study on the front end, whether we can, and to try to look at whether we can impact this and prevent people from becoming victims, it just seems to me that it's the height of prudence to do that instead of always reacting. And, you know, everybody wants to say how unsafe it is to ever put somebody on provisional discharge in that MSOP program. And yet, we don't do anything on the front end to find out if we're really creating safety in our state. I just think that's a shame and very fiscally imprudent. So if we're going to do reform, 2.0, 3.0, or whatever it is, this is where reform really needs to happen. So appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Al. I guess that's a statement. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another real question.
Actually, statements are good to have.
Statements are good?
People,
I like action, though. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
McDonald, you may have a statement or a question. Which would you like?
Okay, both, but quickly.
Well, you only get one.
Oh. Well, in that case, I'll make Apple. It prudent.
Fine.
According to the data that you passed out with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, under the community-based demonstration grants, you signify, very wisely I would submit, that you would show how a similar model can be used to coordinate and leverage the impact of local sexual violence and prevention resources. According to Representative Liebling, there is hardly any. 30 states don't have a program. I hope that in the states that some of the states have a program. So do you mean under this similar model, similar models, you'll study the states that have adopted a sexual study, a sexual violence study, and what their successes are? And part two, quickly, out of the line 1.2, the $210,000 that will be established to preventing sexual violence demonstration communities, selecting sites, I hope that doesn't mean bricks and mortars, but goes into the meat of the program to preventing sexual violence.
Ms. Dunn, or Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm happy to answer that. No, this isn't bricks and mortar. This is strictly about staffing and coordinating, ability to coordinate a variety of disparate voices to come together around a common goal of trying to figure out how to stop sexual violence in their community. And so that is clearly the goal. What we talk about in terms of leveraging, we know that there are a variety of individuals and communities who are committed to doing some kind of work, and maybe that is around suicide prevention, maybe it's pregnancy prevention, maybe it's child
physical abuse prevention, chemical abuse prevention. We believe, and in fact, in supporting good good nutrition and good health care for youth. We believe that all of those have tentacles into the sexual violence, anti-sexual violence work. And so when we talk about leveraging, we're talking about bringing those voices together and say, how can we have a larger impact? How can we build on the work that we're already doing that is preventative in some nature and aspect in our community? How can we bring those together and also focus around the issue of preventing sexual violence?
Mr. Chair and members, you can only imagine what it would be like if I brought a bill that was very prescriptive, expressing what we think as government should be the conversation happening in our communities. Instead, this legislation recognizes that these conversations need to happen from the bottom up. It's not bricks and mortar. When I first became a member of the legislature, I went to my first MnCASA meeting, maybe not my first year, but my second year. They had, you know, each year they do a caucus meeting, if you will, where they've invited legislators. I was so pleased to see a really great representation of men and women, Democrats and Republicans, at that first meeting that I went to. And I was both struck by and not surprised by the fact that we, I think, as elected officials, just like Minnesotans, struggle a little bit to talk about issues of human sexuality. And then layer on top of that the idea that we should be talking about how to prevent violence that is sex. These are difficult conversations. And I think that's why we need to be more open about how they are built in a community. And that's why the language is a little bit more generic and certainly not about bricks and mortar.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just quickly follow up. Well, Representative Murphy, this is I agree with the merits of the bill.
Thank you.
And I think we have to do something. We're all aware of that. But I would encourage you, and you'll have my support, once we have the data, if there's another state out there that have done this, that have had a model, that we can at least have some teeth to the program, that it's not just leveraging the concerns of the victims, although we should spend more money on them as well, but some real hard data that we can actually do something about this and have the materials necessary, the resources necessary to prevent as much as we can this. And then I would encourage you to bring that data with this, and maybe someone's out there that successfully have done this already.
Thanks. You want to say something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, I really appreciate that, and you know, I look forward to earning your support. And for those of you who are inclined, you know, please join me in signing on to the bill. It's an important piece of legislation, and it's an opportunity for us to act to prevent violence against women and children. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to say, because we've kind of diverted into the high end of the repeat sex offenders who are civilly committed, that, you know, unfortunately, this is a day in and day out experience in way too many lives, and it takes many people years, if not decades, to get over it. And while there's, you know, the data here is that one out of five women at some point in their life will be raped, I think there's lesser acknowledgement of the men who are raped, and most of the perpetrators are people who were violated as young people. And they just psychologically reenact things that have happened. Even within our sex offender treatment program, a major share of them are people who are developmentally disabled or functionally very low-functioning people who are just reacting on instinct and re-playing things that they saw adults do in their lives. Every day, people of all ages are threatened with this. It's really been discouraging to read that even when you're in the nursing home, you're not safe from sexual abuse and violence, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's something that haunts so many people for a long, long time. And because we as a society have not been able to set up those discussions in our communities, so many of those victims feel totally isolated and take that shame and blame upon themselves. They don't talk with their friends. They don't talk with their coworkers. It leads to depression. It leads to all kinds of social consequences that we just don't know, the nightmares that helped inspire a downward spiral in many, many lives. And I think by starting within our communities, those dialogues, and empowering people to even just start the discussion about, is this happening in our community? What can we individually do? What can I as a student do to support someone that I see is something's got them off track? Maybe if I just ask some open-ended questions, I can support a friend. I had a relative who had to go to court as a witness for a friend of his who had been had experienced sexual violence in his life by a relative. I mean, it's terrible things are happening in our communities every day. Mm-hmm. And we need to step up and start those dialogues because this is haunting way too many Minnesotans. And it's taking a drag on our success as our state and as communities and individuals. So I'd like to say thanks for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Well, Son Hamilton, I think you get the last question. This has been a good discussion.
Well, actually, I had a comment. I just want to, I would like to thank Representative Murphy as well. You know, education is never part of the problem. It's always part of the solution. And like you were saying, and yourself as well, about having these conversations, they may be uncomfortable and difficult, but they're important. And I remember having the conversation with my children when they were little, with my son specifically, the whole good touch, bad touch, you know? And it's important. It was funny, his reaction. He said, "Dad, if anybody tries, I'll just say, hey, touch your own pee-pee, right?" I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. But the thing is, and then he said, "And then I'll come tell you." But the whole thing is, and like I said, I apologize if I offended anybody, but the whole thing is, we've always been very open and direct in having those conversations, and it's extremely important. And I know one of the biggest concerns, my daughter going off to college, is this, right? And so we sat down as a family and had a very direct conversation. I sat down with her, right, and had a very direct conversation with her as well, as far as what you can do to prevent it, and for your friends to be there for them as well, and what would take place in the event, what you should do. And so as uncomfortable as it is, it's extremely important. So again, I apologize if I offended anybody with what I said, but it's kind of funny. It just adds a little, you know, shed a little whatever. Thank you for bringing that forward.
Actually, you don't get the last comment. Representative Gottlieb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add, you know, this is a good thing to bring forward. Representative Murphy, I'm glad you're bringing it forward. We also have to recognize this takes more than grants, and it takes a village to deal with this because it's not just about bad touch. It is also about violence. And violence comes from many sources, but I would agree with what Representative Loeffler indicated. It's often cyclical. It starts somewhere and it continues. And breaking that cycle requires an entire community effort. Grants to begin discussions can be a good beginning point, but parents have to take responsibility. Families need to take responsibility. Faith communities can play a role in this. Law enforcement does play a role in this, unfortunately. So it takes a variety of strategies to really deal with this meaningfully. I think I don't profess to be an expert, but I've been around this issue enough as a city council member and as a worker for the church in the past that we know that it takes much more than this. So grants may be a start, but I hope we don't think about passing this kind of thing and then kind of patting ourselves on the back that we've solved the problem.
Good point.
Well, I think that's a good discussion. We should have warned people about the content when they came in, not just Reps and Hamiltons, but the whole topic is it's actually good to have an adult conversation about this. And I think it's productive, and thanks, Reps and Murphy, for bringing this forward, and Ms. Dunn for coming to help us do that. And so it's
Mr. Chair, could I?
Oh, you have the last word.
Thank you.
Very last word.
I actually would like to advertise a little something. Today is Leap Day, and we have a campaign going on today called Leap Forward for Prevention.
Oh, yeah.
This is a virtual rally, and we're inviting people to become engaged by signing on to our Demand the Change for Children website. There's a we've got a handout here that I'd like to make available to people. But we'd like you to join. And what we're trying to do is starting an online and a virtual conversation about what we can do in Minnesota, because there are many people like those of you who have spoken up who said it's time to do something.
Representative McDonald is already checking it out. So there you go. That is one of the longest names for a website. But that's you win that contest, too. So thank you for coming. And the bill's held over. It's a good discussion. Representative Hamilton.
Hi.
We have some time left for your business. Sorry, time's up.
Better up.
And actually, I put an article in your stuff here. Representative Murphy, you've worked on provider contracting issues before. This is the feds are going after some Medicare overpayments to health plans, and they're
Jay Jones,
and they're actually. Doing a sampling a few and imputing the rest, which we have found to be offensive in Minnesota when some certain plans do that. Representative Murphy, I don't know if you were paying attention. There's a handout. Representative Murphy. Aaron? I was just I put this is in our pack. You don't have to say anything, but this is about remember the provider contracting bills they've done?
Yes.
The feds are doing it to health plans. I'm sure they'll be complaining to us about imputing that they sample 200 and then multiply by the rest and charge back a whole bunch of money. So I just thought that was kind of funny it happened to them too. So I was just thought you should.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
Oh, where did this come from? Where?
The paper the last day or two.
Dr. Real?
Just probably. I should have put the source. It's so very. Oh, yeah, Star Tribune just a couple days ago. I should have put the date on it, sorry. There's geese and there's ganders, and sometimes they get to coincide. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee. Do you want to move your bill for possible and what's good for the goose is good for the gander, you know? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyway,
I move House File 2423.
Not any kind of a setup for your bill.
I move House File 2423 be held over for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right.
And there's a fiscal note that goes with that, too. So you
there
know,
is, and I believe that. Everybody has a copy of that,
right.
Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I would say that everyone around this table prioritizes and wants to do right for people with disabilities. I understand that we had an extremely difficult year here this last year to address the budget. What I'm hoping to do, and we do have some testifiers here as well, is that I know that the state has requested a waiver. And in the event that waiver is not approved, there would be an additional or a 1.67% reduction to folks with disabilities. So I'm hoping to have that safety net. So that's the intent, to have those dollars there available to protect this population from a reduction, additional reduction of 1.67%. Mr. Chairman, that's the gist of the bill. I do have couple testifiers here, if you like testimony at this time.
I wish I understood the topic worse, so I share your concerns. So
thank you.
So welcome to the committee. I'd be happy to hear testifiers, and maybe the department can come give us their best idea of what they think is the status of this as well when they finish. So we have. He's hiding. Yeah, he's hiding. Yeah. So maybe if you can just take a couple minutes each. Looks like there's actually some others who have signed up besides that. There's five witnesses. So we have 17 minutes left in the hour. So welcome to the committee. You can do the math. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chair Abler and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Lynn Megan. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition, a provider association representing day training and habilitation providers from throughout Minnesota. Our members provide services to over 12,500 people with disabilities in all 87 of our counties. DT&H services provide employment, community involvement, therapies, transportation, and other individualized services to some of Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens. I'm employed as president of TSE, a community day training habilitation provider that provides training, support, and employment for over 300 people with disabilities throughout Ramsey County. I urge you to support the repeal of the 1.67 contingent rate cut for the following reasons. An additional cut in disability funding harms Minnesotans with disabilities, their families, and people who provide services to them. These individuals, as Representative Hamilton has spoken, have already been cut through the 2011 budget bill. I'm confident to say that at TSE and other MHC organizations, we continue to provide amazingly and wonderfully quality services to the people that we support in spite of the major cuts that we've sustained over the past years. In fact, last night at a board meeting at TSE, we presented our consumer satisfaction survey. We have never had as best results than we had last night. We had so many excellent services. So we do step to the plate and continue to provide the supports that people with disabilities request, deserve, and ask for. That said, we cannot continue to sustain cuts without affecting the quality of our services and our business sustainability. The quality of our services is completely reliant on strong management and the competence and experience of our staff teams. Without adequate compensation, providers are unable to recruit or retain quality staff. Direct service staff members make, on average, less than $12 per hour. For that wage, people look for jobs with a lot less stress and personal responsibility. In the majority of our member organizations, wages are frozen and have been frozen for 4 years. Since 2003, day training rehabilitation organizations have received cumulative rate decreases of 3.58%, while inflation has grown over 20%. As private nonprofits, day training organizations are well managed and serve a public purpose. In fact, at TSE, our administrative cost is less than 10% of our budget. We are businesses. We are subject to the same economic challenges faced by private and government sectors. Our fixed costs continue to rise in areas like health insurance, fuel, and utilities. At the same time, rates and our private giving have declined. Effects of our most recent cuts are employees have been laid off, wages have been frozen for the past 4 years. Some organizations have dropped the valuable health insurance for our employees. Other benefits have been reduced, such as vacation time, holidays, and non-paid furloughs have been implemented. An additional rate cut brings the service system closer to the tipping point and puts people with disabilities at the risk of losing support so desperately needed and cannot live without. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. And again, we urge you to support a repeal of the 1.67 rate cut, House File 2423. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Abler and members of the committee. My name is Jay Jones, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Home Care Association. To urge you to favorably consider the bill, which would rescind the 1.67% reduction in reimbursements for certain continuing care services, the third reduction in 4 years. The bill is House File 2423, sponsored by Representative Hamilton. You're all aware that the segment of our population age 65 or older is our fastest growing age group. By 2030, the size of this group will have doubled from its 2000 level, and this demographic shift will place extraordinary demands on our healthcare infrastructure. The vast majority of these elders will prefer to remain in their home rather than be cared for in an institution. For those whose medical and personal care needs can be met at home, home care is arguably the most cost-effective way to provide the needed cares. And home care can reduce the need for admission or readmission to the most expensive part of our healthcare system, our hospitals, and our emergency rooms. Today, our home care delivery infrastructure is adequate. From homemaking and PCA services to Medicare-certified skilled nursing and therapy, more than 1,000 agencies serve clients in all 87 Minnesota counties. Preserving the health of this infrastructure is critical in coping with the coming elder explosion without breaking the budget. Near-term savings gained at the expense of this critical care delivery capability will prove to be false economies. You may ask whether we can afford to consciously protect this infrastructure from continuous cuts as we go forward. I would ask if we can afford not to. Expenditures for hospitals, doctors, and pharmaceuticals combined account for about two-thirds of the money spent on health care in Minnesota. In contrast, home health care receives about 4%. It's one of the best bargains anywhere in health care. Help us protect this infrastructure so that it's there when we need it. We urge you to roll back the planned 1.67% reimbursement reductions in continuing care. We need to recruit, train, and manage the caring, high-quality caregivers you would feel comfortable leaving an elderly loved one with in their home. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Nelson, if you want to come down, and Ms. Holstey and Thurston, if you want to take a minute or two each. I kind of suspect I know what you're going to say, but go ahead. I know you like to be timed, so I You work well under pressure, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson from ARM, and we represent disability providers. We're an association of disability providers from across Minnesota. I'll just add this to the points that have already been made. When the bill emerged from special session and we sat down with the department and other folks, it seemed apparent at that time that there would be no problem getting the approval through CMS, and although we told our members that a 1.67% cut could happen, be ready, not everybody is totally prepared for it because they expected the request to CMS to go through. Others did prepare for it. Just wanted to clarify also that when this comes on top, as Ms. Meegan was talking about, on top of some other cuts, of the 10% low need cut, of the, for other people, for the across the board 1.5% cut, and 75% of all of our expenditures go to staff, in other words, go to services. The other 25%, they're primarily fixed costs. So what the impact of this will be directly to services, directly to people who haven't seen an increase, many of them for many, many years. It'll mean fewer hours. It'll be a cutback on services. So if there's a way to do this, I implore you to roll back this cut, and thank you, Representative Hamilton.
I appreciate that. And Mr. Godfrey, if you want to kind of grab a chair while they're doing their testimony too, that then we can ask you a few questions. Welcome to the committee. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I represent Aging Services of Minnesota.
I'm Heidi Holstey. I represent Care Providers of Minnesota, and together we're the Long-Term Care Imperative.
So we're going to share our testimony in the interest of being time efficient. I wish I had a story as memorable as Representative Hamilton's to capture the attention of the committee.
That's a different topic.
But I didn't come that prepared. But I do want to thank Representative Hamilton for bringing forward House File 2423. The imperative does support this legislation, and it is an important issue for us. The imperative represents several types of providers that would be impacted by the contingent 1.67% cut, including providers of customized living and 24-hour customized living, more commonly known as assisted living providers, also home care providers, those that participate in the alternative care program, and also we do have several members that participate in the CADI program. All of these programs are designed in part as alternatives to nursing homes and institutional care. They are in part designed to provide more cost-effective services in a least restrictive environment, and I think that's important to keep in mind as we discuss this issue. If nothing is done to address the contingent 1.67% contingent rate cut, it will fall on the backs of providers that have dealt with double-digit cuts when added up over the last 3 years. I'm just going to highlight a couple of the cuts that were made during the 2011 session to give you sort of a flavor of what our folks have had to deal with just in the last year. But again, I want to highlight that if you add up the cuts over the last 3 years, that they are, in fact, double-digit cuts. The Elderly Waiver Program, which pays for, again, services in assisted living as well as in home care, was cut by $17 million last year. That includes a 5% cut to customized living and 24-hour customized living rates, and a 1.5% cut to fee-for-service home care services. In addition, and this gets a little bit complicated, so bear with me here a little bit, there were deeper reductions to rate limits for clients that fall in the category called EW Case Mix L category. And bear with me as I walk through this.
You don't have a lot of time to
work. No, I understand that, and I'll be brief.
There you go.
Criteria for Case Mix A was increased. So we actually first more people in Case Mix L. These are folks that live in assisted living. But then we also reduced the service limit for Case Mix L clients by $500 last year. In addition, the rate limit was reduced by 25%, which was on top of the 5% customized living rate cut. So there is a significant component of clients in customized living, living in assisted living, that had even deeper cuts, double-digit cuts, even as a result of the 2011 legislative session. And that's just the flavor of some of the reductions that folks are dealing with, really ask you to pay attention to this particular issue.
Thank you, Ms. Holsky.
And Mr. Chair, I just have two additional points. One is that the concern that we have is that an additional cut will have a disproportionate impact on our rural members. We knew of two that specifically told us that they closed last year due to the cuts on their rates. And the other point that I want to make is that while the bill focuses on the 1.67 contingent cut, we do want to also point out that from the long-term care provider's perspective, the level, nursing facility level of care waiver, whether it goes into effect based on the approval by the feds or in January 1 of 2014, is a concern because we do have concerns that the infrastructure may not be there for the people who will be losing MA eligibility when that is in effect.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Godfrey. So did they acknowledge you received it yet? How are the discussions going with Chicago or wherever you're talking about this?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey, State Medicaid Director at DHS. And in response to your question, Mr. Chair, as we've discussed, I believe, at the last hearing I appeared at, we did submit the waiver on February 13th. We've had staff-level conversations with CMS staff in both Baltimore and Chicago. We are in the midst of scheduling a conference call with CMS leadership to walk through the waiver with them. And that's really the state of things at the moment. We do hope to get some clear guidance after that leadership call with CMS around the likelihood of approval for the waiver. CMS is not always interested in perhaps providing us with that sort of guidance, but we're going to be clear with them that we do have this rate cut that's going into effect on July 1st, and we also have a legislature that's in session, and that sort of guidance could be very useful for your decision making here. And so that's essentially where we're at with the waiver negotiation process. We have had conversations with at least half the congressional delegation. We will be attempting to reach out to the remainder of the congressional delegation to brief them on this proposal. And also we will be, we're meeting as a department to discuss, I guess we'll call it a public engagement strategy around trying to connect with people who would like to support this waiver effort or this waiver application, whether it's legislators or stakeholders or others, and help them in terms of if they need assistance in terms of messaging or who to get that information to in support of the waiver.
So it's, and I knew you didn't know the answer all the way, but that's very helpful as an update. Because this was passed in 2009?
That's correct.
Under a different administration, under entirely different partisan leadership, and so is the fact you have a bipartisan agreement with two governors and two entirely different makeups of legislatures, does that help? And are those groups still in place to support it, or is that what you're finding?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think, yes, anytime that we have the support of the legislature, both parties of the legislature, the majority of the legislature, and the governor's office supporting the same a proposal to CMS, it strengthens that proposal in terms of our negotiating position.
Yeah. Because it's about a $23 million problem for this biennium, and there's a half a year in 2014, which is the reason it's a smaller number. Is that correct? The fiscal note 16 point something for 14 and 22.8. Is that why it's smaller the second year, right? It's a half a year?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I'm being told by continuing care staff that is the case.
Telepathic head nodding, that's
yes.
Good. All right. Well, I appreciate that. The members have questions. This is on my mind. It's on my list of things that I worry about. I'm glad that Representative Hamilton brought it forward. The testifiers, I agree. I understand. I hope we can make this not happen. Anybody have questions about this besides? Did you sit there for the whole committee, and did you hear the child care thing, and did we hear for that, or did you come at the end?
Mr. Chair, I was in and out of the committee room.
Okay, well, that's good. We do child care work here sometimes, too, just to point out. So this is one of those days, so I hope you could have learned by that, too. So, members, I think we've accomplished our work. The bill's held over for possible inclusion, and we're adjourned. Oh, listen, do you want to have a... Yeah, we're done.
Thank you.